Chapter 33. Midsummer's Eve. June the 20th, 1971. On Midsummer's Eve in Scotland, the sun hangs in the sky with the moon. Summer solstice, the feast of Litha, Alban Isla. Nearly midnight, and the light was dim and milky white, but light nonetheless. He could feel the stones long before he saw them. Claire and Gilles had both been right, he thought. The date mattered. They had been eerie on his earlier visits, but silent. Now he could hear them. Not with his ears, but with his skin. A low buzzing hum like the drone of bagpipes. They came over the crest of the hill and paused, 30 feet from the circle. Below was dark glen, a mystery under the rising sun. He heard a small intake of breath at his elbow, and it occurred to him that Fiona was seriously afraid.
"Look, you don't need to be here," he told her. "If you're afraid, you should go on down. I'll be all right."
"It's not me I'm scared for, fool," she muttered, thrusting her bald fists deeper into her pockets. She turned away, lowering her head like a little bull as she faced up the path. "Come on, then." The alder bushes rustled near his shoulder, and he shivered suddenly, feeling a cold qualm go over him, warmly as he was dressed. His dress seemed suddenly ridiculous, the long-skirted coat and the waistcoat in thick wool, the matching breeches and knitted stockings. A play at the college, he had told the tailor who made the costume. "Fool is right," he muttered to himself. Fiona went first into the circle. She wouldn't let him come with her, or watch. Obediently, he turned his back, letting her do whatever she intended. She had a plastic shopping bag, presumably containing items for her ceremonial. He had asked what was in it, and she had tersely told him to mind his own business. She was nearly as nervous as he was, he thought. The humming noise disturbed him. It wasn't in his ears, but in his body, under his skin. In his bones. It made the long bones of his arms and legs thrum like plucked strings, and itched in his blood, making him want constantly to scratch. Fiona couldn't hear it. He'd asked, to be sure she was safe before letting her help him. He hoped to God he was right, that only those who heard the stones could pass through them. He'd never forgive himself if anything happened to Fiona, though, as she'd pointed out, she'd been in this circle any number of times on the fire feasts with no ill effect. He sneaked a look over one shoulder, saw a tiny flame burning at the base of the big cleft stone, and jerked his head back around. She was singing in a soft, high voice. He couldn't make out the words. All the other travellers he knew of were women. Would it truly work for him?
It might, he thought.
If the ability to pass through the stones was genetic, something like the ability to roll one's tongue into a cylinder, or colour blindness, then why not? Claire had travelled, so had Brianna. Brianna was Claire's daughter. And he was a descendant of the only other time traveller he knew of, Gilles the Witch. He stamped both feet and shook himself like a horse with flies, trying to rid himself of the humming. God, it was like being eaten by ants. Was Fiona's chanting making it worse, or was it only his imagination? He rubbed violently at his chest, trying to ease the irritation, and felt the small round weight of his mother's locket, taken for luck, and for its garnets. He had his doubts about Gilles's speculations. He wasn't about to try blood, though Fiona seemed to be supplying fire. But after all, the gems could do no harm. And if they helped, Christ, would Fiona not hurry? He twisted and strained inside his clothes, trying to get out of not only his clothing, but his skin. Seeking distraction, he patted his breast pocket again, feeling the locket. If it worked. If he could. It was a notion that had come to him only lately, as the possibility posed by the stones had matured into actual planning. But if it were possible. He fingered the small round shape, seeing the face of Jerry Mackenzie on the dark surface of his mind. Brianna had gone to find her father. Could he do the same?
Jesus, Fiona! She was making it worse. The roots of his teeth ached and his skin was burning. He shook his head violently, then stopped, feeling dizzy. The seams of his skull felt as though they were beginning to separate. Then she was there, a small figure grasping his hand, saying something anxious as she led him into the circle. He couldn't hear her. The noise was much worse inside. Now it was in his ears, in his head, blackening his sight, driving wedges of pain between the joints of his spine. Gritting his teeth, he blinked back the buzzing darkness long enough to fix his eyes on Fiona's round and fearful face. Swiftly, he bent and kissed her, full on the mouth.
"Don't tell Ernie," he said.
He turned away from her and walked through the stone. A faint scent came to him on the summer wind, the smell of burning. He turned his head, nostrils flared to catch it. There, a flame flared and bloomed on a nearby hilltop, a rose of midsummer's fire. There were faint stars overhead, half-shadowed by a drifting cloud. He had no urge to move, nor to think. He felt bodiless, embraced by the sky, his mind turning free, reflecting starlit images like the glass bubble of a fisher's float adrift in the surf. There was a soft and musical hum around him, the far-off song of siren stars, and the smell of coffee. A vague feeling of wrongness intruded on his sense of peace. Sensation prodded at his mind, rousing tiny, painful sparks of confusion. He fought back feeling, wanting only to stay afloat in starlight, but the act of resistance woke him. All of a sudden, he had a body again, and it hurt.
"Roger!"
The star's voice blared in his ear, and he jerked. Searing pain shot through his chest, and he clapped a hand to the wound. Something seized his wrist and pulled it away, but not before he had felt wetness and the silky roughness of ash on his breast. Was he bleeding?
"Oh, you're wakened, thank God. Aye, there. There's a good lad. Easy, aye?"
It was the cloud talking, not the star. He blinked, confused, and the cloud resolved itself into the curly silhouette of Fiona's head, dark against the sky. He jerked upright, more a convulsion than a conscious movement. His body had come back with a vengeance. He felt desperately ill, and there was a horrible smell of coffee and burned flesh in his nostrils. He rolled onto all fours, retching, then collapsed onto the grass. It was wet, and the coolness felt good on his scorched face. Fiona's hands were on him, soothing, wiping his face and mouth.
"Are you all right?"
she said, for what he knew must be the 100th time. This time he summoned enough strength to answer.
"Aye," he whispered. "All right. Why?"
Her head moved back and forth, wiping out half a sky of stars.
"I don't know. You went? You were gone? And then there was a burst of fire and you were lying in the circle with your coat ablaze. I had to put you out with a thermos bottle."
That accounted for the coffee then, and the soggy feeling over his chest. He lifted a hand, groping, and this time she let him. There was a burnt patch on the wet cloth of his coat, maybe 3 inches across. The flesh of his chest was seared. He could feel the queer, cushioned numbness of blisters through the hole in the cloth, and the nagging pain of a burn spread through his chest. His mother's locket was gone entirely.
"What happened, Rog?"
Fiona was crouching by him, her face dim but visible. He could see the shiny tracks of tears on her face. What he had thought a Midsummer's Eve fire was the flame of her candle, burned down now to the last half inch. God, how long had he been out? He had begun to say that he didn't know, but broke off.
"Let me think a bit, aye?"
He put his head on his knees, breathing in the smell of wet grass and scorched cloth. He concentrated on breathing. Let it come back. He had no real need to think. It was all there, distinct in his mind. But how did one describe such things? There was no sight, and yet he had the image of his father. No sound,
no touch, and yet he had both heard and felt.
The body seemed to make its own sense of things, translating the numinous phenomena of time into concretions.
He raised his head from his knees and breathed deep, settling himself slowly back in his body.
"I was thinking of my father," he said. "When I stepped through the rock, I just thought, if it works, could I go back and find him? And I did."
"You did? Your dad? Was he a ghost, you mean?"
He felt more than saw the flicker of her hand as she made the horns against evil.
"No, not exactly. I can't explain, Fiona, but I met him. I knew him."
The feeling of peace hadn't left him altogether. It hovered there, fluttering gently in the back of his mind.
"Then there was sort of an explosion, is all I can describe it as. Something hit me, here."
His fingers touched the burnt place on his chest.
"The force of it pushed me out. That's all I knew till I woke."
He touched her face gently.
"Thanks, Fee. You saved me burning."
"Oh, get on with you."
She made an impatient gesture, dismissing him. She sat back on her heels, rubbing her chin as she thought.
"I'm thinking, Rog, what it said in her book about there maybe being some protection if you had a gemstone with you.
They were the wee jewels in your mam's locket, no?"
He could hear her swallow. "Maybe, if you hadn't had that, you might not have lived.
She told about the folk who didn't. They were burned, and your burn's where the locket was." "Yes, it could be."
Roger was beginning to feel more like himself. He glanced curiously at Fiona.
"You always say her. Why do you never say her name?"
Fiona's curls lifted in the dawn wind as she turned to look at him. It was light enough now to see her face clearly, with its expression of disconcerting directness.
"You don't call something unless you want it to come," she said. "Surely you know that, and your father a minister."
The hairs on his forearms prickled, despite the covering of shirt and coat.
"Now that you mention it," he said,
trying for a joking tone and failing utterly. "I wasn't quite calling my father's name, but perhaps... Dr. Randall said she thought of her husband when she came back."
Fiona nodded, frowning. He could see her face clearly and realized with a start that the light was growing. It was near dawn. The sky to the east was the shimmered colour of a salmon's scales.
"Christ, it's almost morning. I've got to go."
"Go?"
Fiona's eyes went round with horror.
"You're not going to try it again?"
"I am. I've got to."
The lining of his mouth was cotton dry, and he regretted that Fiona had used all the coffee extinguishing him. He fought down the hollow-bellied feeling and made it to his feet. His knees were wobbly, but he could walk.
"Are you mad, Rog? It'll kill you, sure."
He shook his head, eyes fixed on the tall cleft stone.
"No," he said, and hoped to hell he was right. "No. I know what went wrong. It won't happen again."
"You can't know, not for sure."
"Aye, I do."
He took her hand from his sleeve and held it between his own. It was small and cold. He smiled at her, though his face felt strangely numb.
"I hope Ernie's not come home. He'll have the police looking for you. You'd best hurry back."
She shrugged, impatient. "Oh, he's at the fishing with his cousin Neil. He'll no be back till Tuesday." "What do you mean it won't happen again? Why won't it?"
This was the thing that was harder to explain than the rest of it. He owed it to her to try, though.
"When I said I was thinking of my father, I was thinking of him from what I knew of him, the pictures of him in his airman's kit or with my mother. The thing is, I was born by that time. Do you see?"
He searched her small, round face and saw her blink slowly, comprehending. Her breath left her in a small sigh of fear and wonder mingled. "You didn't only meet your dad then, did you?" she asked quietly.
He shook his head, wordless. No sight, no sound or smell or touch. There were no images at all to convey what it had been like to meet himself.
"I have to go," he repeated softly.
He squeezed her hand.
"Fiona, I cannot say enough to thank you.
She stared at him for a moment, her soft bottom lip thrust out, eyes glistening. Then she pulled loose and, twisting off her engagement ring, put it into his hand.
It's a wee stone, but it's a real diamond, she said. It'll maybe help.
I can't do this.
He reached to give it back, but she took a step backward and put her hands behind her back.
Dinna worry, it's insured, she said. Ernie's a great one for the insurance.
She tried to smile at him, though the tears were running down her face now.
So am I.
There was nothing more to say. He put the ring in the side pocket of his coat and glanced at the great cleft stone, its black sides starting to glimmer as bits of mica and threads of quartz picked up the dawning light. He could hear the hum still, though now it felt more like the pulsing of his blood, something inside him. No words, and no need. He touched her face once lightly in farewell and walked toward the stone, staggering slightly. He stepped into the cleft. Fiona heard nothing, but the still clear air of midsummer's day shimmered with an echoed name. She waited for a long time until the sun rested on top of the stone.
Slania, a harich hoch, she said softly. Luck to you, dear friend.
She went slowly down the hill and didn't look back. Chapter 34 Lallybroch Scotland, June, 1769. The sorrel horse's name was Brutus, but luckily it didn't seem indicative of character so far. More plodder than plotter, he was strong and faithful, or if not faithful, at least resigned. He had carried her through the summer green glens and rock-lined gorges without a slip, taking her higher and higher along the good roads made by the English General Wade 50 years before, and the bad roads beyond the general's reach, splashing through brushy burns and climbing up to the places where the roads dwindled away to nothing more than a red deer's track across the moor. Brianna let the reins lie on Brutus's neck, letting him rest after the last climb, and sat still, surveying the small valley below. The big white-harled farmhouse sat serenely in the middle of pale green fields of oats and barley, its windows and chimneys edged in grey stone, the walled kale yard, and the numerous outbuildings clustering around it like chicks round a big white hen. She had never seen it before, but she was sure. She had heard her mother's descriptions of Lallybroch often enough. And besides, it was the only substantial house for miles. She had seen nothing else in the last 3 days but the tiny stone-walled crofters' cottages, many deserted and tumbled down, some no more than fire-black ruins. Smoke was rising from a chimney below. Someone was home. It was nearly midday. Perhaps everyone was inside, eating dinner. She swallowed, dry-mouthed with excitement and apprehension. Who would it be? Whom would she see first? Ian? Jenny? And how would they take her appearance and her declaration? She had decided simply to tell the truth as far as who she was and what she was doing there. Her mother had said how much she looked like her father. She would have to count on that resemblance to convince them. The Highlanders she had met so far were wary of her looks and strange speech. Perhaps the Murrays wouldn't believe her. Then she remembered and touched the pocket of her coat. No, they'd believe her. She had proof, after all. A sudden thought hollowed her breastbone. Could they possibly be here now, Jamie Fraser and her mother? The thought hadn't occurred to her before. She had been so convinced that they were in America. But that wasn't necessarily so. She only knew they would be in America in 1776. There was no telling where they were right now. Brutus flung up his head and whinnied loudly. An answering neigh came from behind them, and Brianna drew up the reins as Brutus swung around. He lifted his head and nickered, nostrils flaring with interest as a handsome bay horse came round the bend of the road, carrying a tall man in brown. The man pulled up his horse for a moment when he saw them, then twitched a heel against the bay's side and came on slowly. He was young, she saw,
and deeply tanned despite his hat. He must spend a good deal of time outdoors. The skirt of his coat was rumpled, and his stockings were covered with dust and foxtails. He came up to her warily, nodding as he came within speaking distance. Then she saw him stiffen in surprise and smiled to herself. He had just noticed that she was a woman. The men's clothes she wore would fool no one up close. Boyish was the last word one would use to describe her figure. They served their purpose well enough, though. They were comfortable for riding, and, given her height, made her look like a man on horseback at a distance. The man swept off his hat and bowed to her, surprise plain on his face. He wasn't strictly good-looking, but had a pleasant, strong sort of face with feathery brows, presently raised high, and soft brown eyes under a thick cap of curly hair, black and glossy with good health. "Madam," he said, "might I assist you?" She took off her own hat and smiled at him. "I hope so," she said. "Is this place Lallybroch?" He nodded, wariness now added to his surprise as he heard her odd accent. "It is, Sue. Will you be having some business here?" "Yes," she said firmly, "I will." She drew herself up straight in the saddle and took a deep breath. "I'm Brianna Fraser." It felt odd to say it aloud. She'd never used the name before. It seemed strangely right, though. The wariness on his face diminished, but the puzzlement didn't. He nodded cautiously. "Your servant, ma'am. Jimmy Fraser Murray," he added formally, bowing, "of Broch Tuach."
"Young Jamie!" she exclaimed, startling him with her eagerness. "You're young Jamie!"
"My family calls me so," he said stiffly, managing to give her the impression that he objected to having the name used wantonly by strange women in unsuitable clothes.
"Pleased to meet you," she said undaunted.
She extended a hand to him, leaning from her saddle.
"I'm your cousin."
The brows, which had come down during the introductions, popped back up. He looked at her extended hand, then, incredulously, at her face.
"Jamie Fraser is my father," she said.
His jaw dropped, and he simply goggled at her for a moment. He looked her over minutely, head to toe, peered closely at her face, and then a wide, slow smile spread across his own.
"Damned if he isn't," he said.
He seized her hand and squeezed it tight enough to grind the bones together.
"Christ, you've the look of him."
He paused, humour transforming his face.
"Jesus," he said, "my mother will have kittens."
The great rose briar that overhung the door was newly in leaf, hundreds of tiny green buds just forming. Brianna looked up at it as she followed young Jamie and caught sight of the lintel over the door.
Fraser, 1716, was carved into the weathered wood.
She felt a small thrill at the sight and stood staring up at the name for a moment, the sun-warm wood of the jam solid under her hand.
"All right, cousin."
Young Jamie had turned to look back at her inquiringly.
"Fine."
She hurried into the house after him, automatically ducking her head, though there was no need.
"We're mostly tall, save my ma'am and wee Kitty," young Jamie said with a smile, seeing her duck. "My grandsire, your grandsire, too, built this house for his wife, who was a very tall woman herself. It's the only house in the Highlands where you can go through a doorway without ducking or bashing your head, I expect."
"Your grandsire, too." The casual words made her feel suddenly warm, in spite of the cool dimness of the entry hall. Frank Randall had been an only child, as had her mother. Such relatives as she had weren't close, only a couple of elderly great-aunts in England and some long-distant second cousins in Australia. She had set out thinking only to find her father. She hadn't realized that she might discover a whole new family in the process.
A lot of family.
As she entered the hallway with its scarred panelling, a door opened and four small children ran out, closely pursued by a tall young woman with brown curly hair.
"Ah, run for it, wee fishies," she cried, rushing forward with outstretched hands, snapping like pinchers.
The wicked crab will have you eaten up. Snap, snap.
The children fled down the hall in a gale of giggles and shrieks, looking back over their shoulders in terrified delight. One of them, a little boy of 4 or so, saw Brianna and young Jamie standing in the entryway and instantly reversed his direction, charging down the hallway like a runaway locomotive, shouting, "Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!" The boy flung himself recklessly at young Jamie's midriff. The latter caught him expertly and hoisted the beaming little boy in his arms.
"Now then, wee Matthew," he said sternly, "what sort of manners is this your Auntie Janet's teaching you? What will your new cousin be thinking to see you dashing about with no more sense than a chicken after corn?"
The little boy giggled louder, not at all put off by the scolding. He peeked at Brianna, caught her eye, and promptly buried his face in his father's shoulder. Slowly he raised his head and peeked again, blue eyes wide.
"Da," he said. "Is that a lady?"
"Of course she is. I've told you she's your cousin."
"But she's got on breeks."
Matthew stared at her in shock.
"Ladies dunno wear breeks."
The young woman looked rather as though she subscribed to this opinion as well, but she interrupted firmly, moving to take the little boy from his father.
"Well, and I'm sure she's a fine reason for it, but it isn't proper to be making remarks before people's faces. You go and get yourself washed, eh?"
She set him down and pushed him toward the door at the end of the hallway, giving him a gentle push. He didn't move, but turned back around to stare at Brianna.
"Where's Granny, Matt?" his father asked.
"In the back parlour, with Granda and a lady and a man," Matthew replied promptly. "They've had 2 pots of coffee, a tray of scones, and a whole Dundee cake. But Mama says they're hanging on in hopes of being fed dinner too, and good luck to them because it's only brose and a bit of hoch today and damned... Ooh!"
He pressed his hand over his mouth, glancing guiltily at his father.
"And Rat, if she'll gie them any of the gooseberry tart, no matter how long they stay."
Young Jamie gave his son a narrow look, then glanced quizzically at his sister.
"A lady and a man."
Janet made a faint moo of distaste.
"The grizzler and her brother," she said.
Young Jamie grunted with a glance at Brianna.
"I imagine Mam will be pleased for an excuse to get away from them, then."
He nodded at Matthew.
"Go and fetch your granny, lad. Tell her I've brought a visitor she'll like to see. And watch your language, aye?"
He turned Matthew toward the back of the house and slapped him gently on the rump in dismissal. The little boy went, but slowly, casting glances of intense fascination over his shoulder at Brianna as he went. Young Jamie turned back to Brianna, smiling.
"That'll be my eldest," he said, "and this," gesturing to the young woman, "is my sister, Janet Murray. Janet, Mistress Brianna Fraser."
Brianna didn't know whether to offer to shake hands or not, and instead contented herself with a nod and a smile.
"I'm very pleased to meet you," she said warmly.
Janet's eyes sprang wide with amazement, whether at what Brianna had said or at the accent with which she'd spoken, Brianna couldn't tell. Young Jamie grinned at his sister's surprise.
"You'll never guess who she is, Jen," he said. "Never in 1,000 years."
Janet lifted one eyebrow, then narrowed her eyes at Brianna.
"Cousin," she murmured, looking their guest frankly up and down. "She's the look of the Mackenzies, surely, but she's a Fraser, you see."
Her eyes sprang suddenly wide.
"Oh, you can't be,"
she said to Brianna. A wide smile began to spread across her face, pointing up the family resemblance to her brother.
"You can't be."
Her brother's chortle was interrupted by the swish of a swinging door and the sound of light footsteps on the boards of the hallway.
"Aye, Jimmy. Matty says we've a guest."
The soft, brisk voice died away, and Brianna looked up, her heart suddenly in her throat. Jenny Murray was very small, no more than 5 feet tall, and delicately boned as a sparrow. She stood staring at Brianna, mouth slightly open. Her eyes, with a deep blue of gentians, made them more striking by a face gone white as paper.
Oh, my, she said softly. Oh, my.
Rihanna smiled tentatively, nodding to her aunt, her mother's friend, her father's beloved only sister.
Oh, please, she thought, suddenly suffused with a longing as intense as it was unexpected. Please like me. Please be happy I'm here.
Young Jamie bowed elaborately to his mother, beaming.
Mum, might I have the honour to present to you?
Jamie Fraser, I kent he was back. I told you, Jenny Murray.
The voice rang out from the back of the hallway in tones of high-pitched accusation. Glancing up in startlement, Brianna saw a woman emerging from the shadows, rustling with indignation.
Amyas Ketterick told me he'd seen your brother riding near Balriggan. But no, you wouldn't have it, would you, Jenny? Telling me I'm a fool. Telling me Amyas is blind and Jamie in America. Liars, the both of you, you and Ian, trying to protect that wicked coward. Hobart, she shouted, turning toward the back of the house. Hobart, come out here this minute.
Be quiet, said Jenny impatiently. You are a fool, Lyra.
She jerked at the woman's sleeve, urging her around.
And as for who's blind, look at her. Are you too far past it to tell the difference between a grown man and a lass in breeks, for heaven's sake?
Her own eyes stayed fixed on Brianna, bright with speculation.
Alas!
The other woman turned, frowning nearsightedly at Brianna. Then she blinked once, anger erased as her round face went slack with surprise. She gasped, crossing herself.
Mary, Margaret and Bride, who in the name of God are you?
Brianna took a deep breath, looking from one woman to the other as she answered, trying to keep her voice from shaking.
My name is Brianna. I'm Jamie Fraser's daughter.
Both women's eyes popped wide. The woman called Lyra grew slowly red and seemed to swell, opening and closing her mouth in a futile search for words.
Jenny stepped forward, though, and seized Brianna's hands, looking up into her face. A soft pink bloomed in her cheeks, making her look suddenly young.
Jamie's? You're truly Jamie's lassie?
She squeezed Brianna's hands hard between her own.
My mother says so.
Brianna felt the answering smile on her own face. Jenny's hands were cool, but Brianna felt a rush of warmth nonetheless, which spread through her hands and up into her chest. She caught the faint, spicy scent of baking in the folds of Jenny's gown, and something else, more earthy and pungent, that she thought must be the smell of sheep's wool.
"Does she so?"
Lyra had recovered both her voice and her self-possession. She stepped forward, eyes narrowed.
"Jamie Fraser's your father, aye? And just who might your mother be?"
Brianna stiffened.
"His wife?" she said. Who else?
Lyra put back her head and laughed. It wasn't a nice laugh.
Who else?
She said, mimicking.
Who else indeed, lassie? And just which wife would that be now?
Brianna felt the blood drain from her own face and her hands grow stiff in Jenny's as the flood of realization washed over her.
You idiot, she thought. You stupid idiot.
It was 20 years. Of course he would have married again. Of course. No matter how much he loved Mama. On the heels of this thought was another, more terrible. Did she find him? Oh, God. Did she find him with a new wife and he sent her away?
Oh, God, where is she?
She turned blindly, wanting to run, not knowing where to go, what to do, only feeling that she must get out of here at once and find her mother.
You'll be wanting to sit down, I expect, cousin. Come into the parlour, aye?
Young Jamie's voice was firm in her ear, and his arm was around her, turning her, urging her down the hall and through one of the doors that opened off it. She scarcely heard the babble of voices around her, the confusion of explanations and accusations that popped around her ears like strings of firecrackers. She glimpsed a small, neat man with a face like the White Rabbit, looking vastly surprised, and another man, much taller, who rose as she came into the parlour and came toward her, his weathered, homely face creased in concern. It was the tall man who calmed the racket and brought everyone to order, extracting from the confused muddle of voices an explanation of her presence.
"Jamie's daughter."
He glanced at her with interest, but looked much less surprised than anyone else so far.
"What's your name, Alanan?"
"Brianna."
She was too upset to smile at him, but he didn't seem to mind.
"Brianna."
He eased himself down on a hassock, motioning her to a seat opposite, and she saw that he had a wooden leg that protruded stiffly to one side. He took her hand and smiled at her, the warm light in his soft brown eyes making her feel momentarily safer.
"I'm your Uncle Ian, lass. Welcome to you."
Her own hand tightened on his involuntarily, clinging to the refuge he seemed to offer. He didn't flinch or draw back, just looked her over carefully, seeming amused by the way she was dressed.
"Been sleeping in the heather, have you?"
he said, seeing the dirt and plant stains on her clothes.
"You'll have come some ways to find us, niece."
"She says she's your niece,"
Lyra said. Recovered from her shock, she peered over Ian's shoulder, her round face pinched with dislike.
"Belike she's only come to see what she can get."
"I shouldn't be calling the kettle black, Lyra," Ian said mildly.
He twisted round to face her.
"Or was it not you and Hobart a half-hour past trying to squeeze £500 from me?"
Her lips pressed tight together, deepening the lines that bracketed her mouth.
"That money's mine," she snapped, "and well you know it. It was agreed to. You witnessed the paper."
Ian sighed. Evidently this wasn't the first he had heard of the matter today.
"I did," he said patiently, "and you'll have your money, so soon as Jamie's able to send it. He's promised, and he's an honourable man, but..."
"Honourable, is it?"
Lyra produced an unladylike snort.
"Is it honourable to commit bigamy, then? Desert his wife and children? Steal away my daughter and ruin her? Honourable?"
She looked at Brianna, eyes bright and hard as fresh-rolled steel.
"I'll ask again, lass. What's your mother's name?"
Brianna simply stared at her, overwhelmed. The stock around her throat was choking her, and her hands felt icy despite Ian's grasp.
"Your mother," Lyra repeated, impatient. "Who was she?"
"It doesn't matter who," Jenny began,
but Lyra rounded on her, face flushed with fury.
"Oh, it matters. If he got her on some army whore or some slut of a maidservant when he was in England, that's one thing. But if she's..." "Lyra, sister, you foul-mouthed bosom!"
Brianna put a stop to the outcry simply by standing up. She was as tall as any of the men and towered over the women. Lyra took one quick step back. Every face in the room was turned to her, marked with hostility, sympathy, or merely curiosity. With a coolness that she didn't feel, Brianna reached for the inner pocket of her coat, the secret pocket she had sewed into the seam only a week before. It seemed like a century.
"My mother's name is Claire," she said, and dropped the necklace on the table.
There was utter silence in the room, save for the soft hissing of the peat fire burning low on the hearth. The pearl necklace lay gleaming, the spring sun from the window picking out the gold-pierced work roundels like sparks. It was Jenny who spoke first. Moving like a sleepwalker, she reached out a slender finger and touched one of the pearls. Freshwater pearls, the kind called baroque, because of their singular, irregular, unmistakable shapes.
"Oh, my," Jenny said softly.
She lifted her head and looked Brianna in the face, the slanted blue eyes shimmering with what looked like tears.
"I am so very glad to see you, niece."
"Where is my mother? Do you know?"
Brianna glanced from face to face, her heart beating heavily in her ears. Lyra wasn't looking at her. Her gaze was fastened to the pearls, face gone cold and frozen. Jenny and Ian exchanged a quick glance. Then Ian stood up, moving awkwardly to bring his leg under him.
"She's with your da," he said quietly, touching Brianna's arm. "Dinna fash yourself, lassie. They're both safe.
Brianna resisted the impulse to collapse with relief. Instead, she let out her breath very carefully, feeling the knot of anxiety loosen slowly in her belly.
"Thank you," she said.
She tried to smile at Ian, but her face felt slack and rubbery. Safe and together.
"Oh, thank you," she thought in wordless gratitude. "Those are mine by rights."
Lyra nodded at the pearls. She wasn't angry now, but coldly self-possessed. Without the distortions of fury, Brianna could see that she had once been very pretty, and was still a handsome woman, tall for a Scot and graceful in her movements. She had the kind of delicate, fair colouring that fades quickly, and had thickened through the middle, but her figure was still erect and firm, and her face still showed the pride of a woman who has known herself beautiful.
"That they're not," said Jenny, with a quick flash of temper. "They were my mother's jewels, that my father gave to Jamie for his wife, and—" "And his wife I am," Lyra interrupted.
She looked at Brianna then, a cold, gauging look.
"I am his wife," she repeated. "I married him in good faith, and he promised me payment for the wrong he did me."
She turned her cold gaze on Jenny.
"It's been more than a year since I've seen a penny. Am I to sell my shoes to feed my daughter, the one he's left to me?"
She lifted her chin and looked at Brianna.
"If you're his daughter, then his debts are yours as well. Tell her, Hobart."
Hobart looked mildly embarrassed.
"Ah, no, sister," he said,
putting a hand on her arm in an attempt to be soothing.
"I dinna think—" "No, you don't, and you haven't since you were born."
She shook him off in irritation and stretched out a hand toward the pearls.
"They're mine."
It was pure reflex. The pearls were clutched tight in Brianna's hand before she had made the decision to snatch them. The gold roundels were cool against her skin, but the pearls were warm, the sign of a genuine pearl, her mother had told her.
"You wait just one minute here."
The strength and coldness of her own voice surprised her.
"I don't know who you are, and I don't know what happened between you and my father, but I am Lyra Mackenzie, and your bastard of a father married me 4 years ago, under false pretenses, I might add."
Lyra's anger had not disappeared, but seemed to have submerged. Her face had a tight, stretched look. She wasn't shouting, and the red had faded from her soft, plump cheeks. Brianna took a deep breath, striving for calmness.
"Yes, but if my mother is with my father now—" "He left me."
The words were spoken without heat, but they fell with the weight of stones in still water, spreading endless ripples of pain and betrayal. Young Jamie had been opening his mouth to speak. He shut it again, watching Lyra.
"He said that he could not bear it longer, to dwell in the same house with me, to share my bed."
She spoke calmly, as though reciting a piece she had learned by heart, her eyes still fixed on the empty spot where the pearls had rested.
"So he left. Then he came back, with the witch. Flaunted her in my face, bedded her under my nose."
Slowly she raised her eyes to Brianna's, studying her with quiet intensity, searching out the mysteries of her face. Slowly she nodded.
"It was she," she said,
with a certainty that was faintly eerie in its calmness.
"She cast her spells on him from the day she came to Leoch, and on me. She made me invisible. From the day she came, he could not see me."
Brianna felt a small shiver run up her spine, despite the hissing peat fire on the hearth.
"And then she was gone. Dead, they said. Killed in the rising. And him come home again from England, free at long last."
She shook her head very slightly. Her eyes still rested on Brianna's face, but Brianna knew Lyra didn't see her any longer.
"But she wasna dead at all," Lyra said softly. "And he was not free. I knew that. I always knew that. You canna kill a witch with steel. They must burn."
Lyra's pale eyes turned to Jenny.
"You saw her, at my wedding. Her fetch standing there between me and him.
You saw her, but you didn't say. I only heard it later when you told Mesri the seer. You should have told me then.
It was not so much an accusation as a statement of fact. Jenny's face had gone pale again, the slanted blue eyes dark with something, perhaps fear. She licked her lips and started to reply, but Lyra's attention had shifted to Ian.
"You'd best be wary, Ian Murray," she said,
her tone now matter-of-fact. She nodded toward Brianna.
"Look at her wheel, man. Is a right woman made so? Taller than most men, dressed as a man, with hands as broad as a dinner plate, fit to choke the life from one of your wains, should she choose."
Ian didn't answer, though his long, homely face looked troubled. Young Jamie's fists clenched, though, and his jaws set tight. Lyra saw it, and a small smile touched the corners of her mouth.
"She is a witch's child," she said, "and you know it, all of you."
She glanced around the room, challenging each uncomfortable face.
"They should have burned her mother in Crane's Muir, save for the love spell she'd put on Jamie Fraser. Aye, I say be wary of what you've brought into your house."
Brianna brought the flat of her hand down on the table with a thump, startling everyone. "Hogwash," she said loudly. She could feel the blood rushing to her face and didn't care. All the faces were gawking, mouths open, but she had no attention to spare for anyone but Lyra Mackenzie.
"Hogwash," she said again, and pointed a finger at the woman. "If they ought to be wary of anybody, it's you, you fucking murderess."
Lyra's mouth was open wider than anyone's, but no sound came out.
"You didn't tell them all about Cranesmuir, did you?"
"My mother should have, but she didn't. She thought you were too young to know what you were doing."
"You weren't, though, were you?"
"What?" said Jenny in a faint voice.
Young Jamie looked wildly at his father, who stood as though poleaxed, staring at Brianna.
"She tried to kill my mother."
Brianna was having trouble controlling her voice. It cracked and trembled, but she got the words out.
"You did, didn't you? You told her Gillis Duncan was ill and calling for her. You knew she'd go. She always went to anybody sick. She's a doctor. You knew they were going to arrest Gilly Duncan for witchcraft, and if my mother was there, they'd take her too. You thought they'd burn her, and then you could have him. Have Jamie Fraser."
Lyra was white to the lips, her face set like stone. Even her eyes had no life. They were blank and dull as marbles.
"I could feel her hand on him," she whispered. "In our bed, lying there between us with her hand on him, so he would stiffen and cry out to her in his sleep. She was a witch. I always knew."
The room was silent, save for the hissing of the fire and the tender singing of a small bird outside the window. Hobart Mackenzie stirred at last, coming forward to take his sister by the arm.
"Come away, Alannon," he said quietly. "I'll see you safe home now."
He nodded to Ian, who returned the nod, with a small gesture that somehow conveyed both sympathy and regret. Lyra allowed her brother to lead her away, unresisting, but at the door she stopped and turned back. Brianna stood still. She didn't think she could move if she tried.
"If you're Jamie Fraser's daughter,"
Lyra said in a cold, clear voice,
"know this. Your father is a liar and a whoremaster, a cheat and a pander. I wish you well of each other."
She gave in then to Hobart's tugging at her sleeve, and the door swung to behind her. The rage that had filled her drained suddenly away, and Brianna leaned forward, resting her weight on the palms of her hands, the necklace hard and lumpy under her hand. Her hair had come loose, and a thick strand fell over her face. Her eyes were closed against the dizziness that threatened to engulf her, and she felt, rather than saw, the hand that touched her and tenderly smoothed the locks back from her face.
"He went on loving her,"
she whispered, as much to herself as to anyone else.
"He didn't forget her."
"Of course he didn't forget her."
She opened her eyes to see Ian's long face and kind brown eyes 6 inches away. A broad, work-worn hand rested on hers, warm and hard. A hand even larger than her own.
"Neither did we," he said.
"Will you no have a bit more, Cousin Brianna?"
Joan, young Jamie's wife, smiled across the table, serving spoon poised invitingly above the crumbled remains of a gigantic gooseberry tart.
"Thank you, no. I couldn't eat another bite," Brianna said, smiling back. "I'm stuffed."
This made Matthew and his little brother Henry giggle loudly, but a gimlet gleam from their grandmother's eye shut them up sharply. Looking round the table, though, Brianna could see suppressed laughter blooming on all the faces. From grown-ups to toddlers, they all seemed to find her slightest remark endlessly entertaining. It was neither her unorthodox costume nor the sheer novelty of seeing a stranger, she thought, even one stranger than most. There was something else, some current of joy that ran among the members of the family, unseen but lively as electricity. She realized only slowly what it was. A remark from Ian brought it into focus.
"We didn't think that Jamie would ever have a bairn of his own."
Ian's smile across the table was warm enough to melt ice.
"You'll never have seen him, though."
She shook her head, swallowing the remains of the last bite, smiling back in spite of her full mouth. That was it, she thought. They were delighted with her, not so much for her sake, but for Jamie's. They loved him, and they were happy not for themselves, but for him. That realization brought tears to her eyes. Lyra's accusations had shaken her, wild as they were, and it was a great comfort to realize that to all of these people who knew him well, Jamie Fraser was neither a liar nor a wicked man. He was indeed the man her mother thought him. Mistaking her emotion for choking, young Jamie pounded her helpfully on the back, making her choke in good earnest.
"Will you have written Uncle Jamie, then, to see as you were coming to us?" he asked, ignoring her coughing and red-faced spluttering. "No," she said hoarsely. "I don't know where he is."
Jenny's gull-winged brows went up.
"Aye, you said that. I'd forgotten.
Do you know where he is now? He and my mother?"
Brianna bent forward anxiously, brushing pastry crumbs from her jabot. Jenny smiled and rose from the table.
"Aye, I do. More or less. If you've eaten your fill, do you come with me, lassie? I'll fetch his last letter for you."
Brianna rose to follow Jenny, but stopped abruptly near the door. She had vaguely noticed some paintings on the walls of the parlour earlier, but hadn't really looked at them in the rush of emotion and event. She looked at this one, though. Two little boys with red-gold hair, stiffly solemn in kilts and jackets, white shirts with frills showing bright against the dark coat of a huge dog that sat beside them, tongue lolling in patient boredom. The older boy was tall and fine-featured. He sat straight and proud, chin lifted, one hand resting on the dog's head, the other protectively on the shoulder of the small brother who stood between his knees. It was the younger boy Brianna stared at, though. His face was round and snub-nosed, cheeks translucent and ruddy as apples. Wide blue eyes, slightly slanted, looked out under a bell of bright hair, combed into an unnatural tidiness. The pose was formal, done in classic 18th-century style, but there was something in the robust, stocky little figure that made her smile and reach a finger to touch his face.
"Aren't you a sweetie?" she said softly.
"Jimmy was a sweet laddie, but a stubborn wee fiend forby."
Jenny's voice by her ear startled her.
"Beat him or coax him, it made no difference. If he'd made up his mind, it stayed made up. Come, Weema, there's another picture you'll like to see, I think."
The second portrait hung on the landing of the stairs, looking thoroughly out of place. From below, she could see the ornate gilded frame, its heavy carving quite at odds with the solid, battered comfort of the house's other furnishings. It reminded her of pictures in museums. This homely setting seemed incongruous. As she followed Jenny onto the landing, the glare of light from the window disappeared, leaving the painting's surface flat and clear before her. She gasped, and felt the hair rise on her forearms under the linen of her shirt.
It's remarkable, eh?
Jenny looked from the painting to Brianna and back again, her own features marked with something between pride and awe.
Remarkable, Brianna agreed, swallowing.
You see why we came to you at once,
her aunt went on, laying a loving hand against the carved frame.
Yes, yes, I can see that.
It will be my mother, aye? Your grandmother, Ellen Mackenzie.
Yes, Brianna said. I know.
Dust motes stirred up by their footsteps whirled lazily through the afternoon light from the window. Brianna felt rather as though she was whirling with them, no longer anchored to reality. 200 years from now, she had... I will, she thought wildly, stood in front of this portrait in the National Portrait Gallery, furiously denying the truth that it showed. Ellen Mackenzie looked out at her now as she had then, long-necked and regal, slanted eyes showing a humour that didn't quite touch the tender mouth. It wasn't a mirror image by any means. Ellen's forehead was high, narrower than Brianna's, and the chin was round, not pointed, her whole face somewhat softer and less bold in its features. But the resemblance was there, and pronounced enough to be startling. The wide cheekbones and lush red hair were the same. And around her neck was the string of pearls, gold roundels bright in the soft spring sun.
"Who painted it?" Brianna said at last, though she didn't need to hear the answer. The tag by the painting in the museum had given the artist as unknown. But having seen the portrait of the two little boys below, Brianna knew all right. This picture was less skilled, an earlier effort, but the same hand had painted that hair and skin.
"My mother herself," Jenny was saying, her voice filled with a wistful pride. "She'd a great hand for drawing and painting. I often wished I had the gift."
Brianna felt her fingers curl unconsciously, the illusion of the brush between them momentarily so vivid she could have sworn she felt smooth wood.
"That's where," she thought with a small shiver,
and heard an almost audible click of recognition as a tiny piece of her past dropped into place.
"That's where I got it."
Frank Randall had joked that he couldn't draw a straight line. Claire, that she drew nothing else. But Brianna had the gift of line and curve, of light and shadow. And now she had the source of the gift as well.
What else? She thought suddenly.
What else did she have that had once belonged to the woman in the picture, to the boy with a stubborn tilt to his head?
"Ned Gowan brought me this from Leoch," Jenny said, touching the frame with a certain reverence. "He saved it when the English battered down the castle after the rising."
She smiled faintly.
"He's a great one for family, Ned is. He's a lowlander from Edinburgh, with no kin of his own, but he's taken the Mackenzies for his clan. Even now the clan's no more."
"No more?" Brianna blurted. "They're all dead?"
The horror in her voice made Jenny glance at her, surprised.
"Och, no, I didn't mean that, lass. But Leoch's gone," she added in a softer tone, "and the last chief's with it, Colum and his brother Dougal. They died for the Stuarts."
She had known that, of course. Claire had told her. What was surprising was the sudden rush of an unexpected grief, regret for these strangers of her newfound blood. With an effort, she swallowed the thickening in her throat and turned to follow Jenny up the stairs.
"Was Leoch a great castle?" she asked.
Her aunt paused, hand on the banister.
"I dinna ken," she said.
Jenny glanced back at Ellen's picture, something like regret in her eyes.
"I never saw it, and now it's gone."
Entering the bedroom on the second floor was like entering an undersea cavern. The room was small, as all the rooms were, with low beams smoked black from years of peat fires. But the walls were fresh and white, and the room itself was filled with a greenish wavering light that spilled through two large windows, filtered by the leaves of the swaying rosebriar. Here and there some bright thing blinked or glowed like a reef fish in the soft gloom. a painted doll that lay on the hearthrug, abandoned by a grandchild. A Chinese